Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Sociology. I'm Sarah Patterson, one of the hosts here on the channel, and today we're talking with Shiri Noy about her book, Banking on Health, The World Bank and Health Sector Reform in Latin America. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So to get us started, do you mind telling us about yourself?
So I am a political and development sociologist in training. I graduated from Indiana University with my PhD in 2013. And my research has kind of two primary strains. And the one that the book is based on is really looking at social policy reform in developing countries. And so the book is based primarily on dissertation research and then subsequent research in the World Bank archives, and really ties together this kind of interest that I have in globalization and global governance and institutions, and then social policies, in this particular case, health policy in Latin America.
Great. Thank you. So you sort of mentioned it developed out of your dissertation, but can you sort of take us through the process of how the book came about for you?
Yeah. So I think in some ways, my process is a little different from other sociologists that I know that have written books. I come from a department that primarily had scholars that produce kind of peer-reviewed articles, and so it wasn't a kind of heavy book department, I would call it. And when I wrote the dissertation, I thought that I may want to turn it into a book, but I wasn't kind of 100% sure. And what ended up cementing my decision to write it up as a book is that it's a really kind of methodologically kind of diverse project. And so I draw on interview data and archival data and a lot of cross-section time series models. So using kind of quantitative regional data for Latin America and the Caribbean. And so I was finding that I had this big argument that I wanted to make, and I was unable to make that argument in the format of an article, primarily because of the disparate kind of, I guess not just data sources, but also kind of the three countries. And so I thought it was really important to write a book that kind of married the quantitative regional analyses and then the country-specific case studies to make the argument that I make in the book. So, and in terms of the kind of process, so I spent 2011, most of 2011, thanks to an NSF dissertation improvement grant and some monies from Indiana sociology, doing my field research. So I spent about 3 months each in Argentina, Costa Rica, and Peru. And then I kind of realized that I wanted more on the World Bank beyond the interviews I had done in the countries and the kind of quantitative and document analysis, and visited the World Bank archives in 2015 before kind of sitting down to write the full book manuscript.
That's really cool. Actually, this kind of goes into your appendix, but for you, just sort of as a researcher, I'm just kind of curious what it was like to work with all those different sets of data, right? So like you've got the interviews and you've got the policy documents that you went through, as well as the quantitative analysis. So, I mean, when you were doing it, was there anything that you were like, yes, this goes along with that? And just kind of how that process went for you?
Yeah. So I think I was really lucky to come from a department, and I guess in particular, a committee. So kind of my training as a sociologist was really kind of heavily centered on the idea that all data are valuable as long as they're collected kind of validly and reliably, and that really your research question should drive the type of data that you want to collect. Even though the training, my training was primarily kind of quantitative to begin with, and that's kind of how the project began, I found myself asking kind of how and why questions in terms of how the World Bank was involved in health sector reform in Latin America. And those were questions that I just couldn't answer with the kind of cross-national, public and private and overall kind of health spending data that I had been looking at. So I wrote a paper in 2011 that looked at kind of testing classic welfare state theories in the Latin American context in the International Journal of Comparative Sociology. And it also looked at health as a kind of particular domain of welfare states. And I found that the World Bank, like kind of presence of World Bank personnel, and I looked at kind of IMF also, but I found that it didn't really have a negative effect on health expenditure, and in particular public health expenditure. And that was really counter not only to what I expected, right? But also counter to the narratives that we have about the World Bank's work in health in Latin America. So one of the arguments that I make kind of pretty strongly in a 2015 paper on Costa Rica, and I echo in the book, is that, you know, the cases you choose affect the answers that you get. And so a lot of what we know about what the World Bank has done in health in Latin America is based on the Chilean case and to a lesser extent, the Colombian case. And those were cases where there was kind of a heavy shift towards neoliberalism and kind of privatization under Pinochet in particular in Chile. We've heard a lot of like about the Chicago Boys. And so I was really kind of surprised to not find this regional effect. And I suspected that it wasn't because the World Bank didn't matter, but that perhaps it was doing different things in different countries. And so that was kind of what set me on the path to the kind of qualitative case study analyses that I do in the book. And so primarily I did interviews with kind of pretty high-ranking key informants in each of the countries. So Ministry of Health personnel, Social Security personnel, some kind of consultants, World Bank personnel, Inter-American Development Bank people, USAID people in these countries. And then also the other nice thing is that I use a variety of documents, and I actually am able to draw on the population rather than a sample of documents associated with all World Bank projects and loans in Argentina, Costa Rica, and Peru, which are my three countries. And I kind of limited myself to between 1980 and 2005. So projects could have ended after 2005, but I thought that was kind of a good stopping point just to give a little bit of retrospective distance because projects will often last kind of, you know, five, sometimes 10 years. And I started in 1980 because for kind of a couple of reasons. So on the countryside, the 1980s is known in Latin America as kind of the lost decade because it's characterized by deep recession and really a lot of hyperinflation and other kind of economic troubles, I guess I would say. And so this is a time of kind of maximum uncertainty and maximum desperation on the part of government. So if we are expecting them to seek out World Bank help, like this is the time that they're probably most vulnerable to World Bank recommendations. And then the other reason is that 1980 is the year that the World Bank publishes a health sector policy report and formally commits to lending in the health sector. So it's really kind of time zero for the World Bank's kind of work in health. So sorry, that was probably a pretty long-winded answer about data.
No, that's perfect, actually, because my question then is sort of like, why the World Bank? So in why health? So in your book, you say that the World Bank is a uniquely powerful policy advisor, but for maybe people who don't know about the World Bank, can you give us more explanation of like who they are and like why they would be important, especially in health reform?
The World Bank is one of a few kind of international financial institutions. And so I make an argument that these institutions are really powerful and that, in fact, most sociological research about global health at the global governance and institution level is really focused on the World Health Organization. And the World Health Organization is really important. The World Bank and the World Health Organization are thought of as kind of the two global ministries of health. So they wield a lot of kind of normative power in not only telling countries how to solve their health problems, but actually even in kind of framing to countries what should be considered health problems, right? And we see this, I think, probably most forcefully when we think about the Millennium Development Goals and now the Sustainable Development Goals, right? That are, there's a few of them. And they are the same for all countries, even though countries own kind of health, I guess I would say problems or issues, right, or opportunities might be really different. So the World Bank, though, unlike the World Health Organization, is uniquely powerful because it has money. So it leverages not just normative power, but quite a bit of financial power. And what's important to know about the World Bank is that it's a lender of last resort. So the World Bank doesn't go to countries and kind of give them money. Countries have to request loans from the World Bank. So I think it's often thought that the World Bank kind of decides what countries should do. And it does in the sense that it can approve or deny a loan, but actually countries are the ones that have to formulate the loan, although they oftentimes do that in conversation, I guess I would say, with the World Bank. But so it wields a lot of financial power because it's a lender of last resort. So if countries can get capital from private banks or other kind of institutions, the World Bank will not lend to them. And kind of more broadly, the World Bank started as kind of a Bretton Woods institution in 1944, and it was originally the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, kind of post-World War II rebuilding, and since it's become really a development bank. And so in terms of the kind of mechanism that the World Bank can use to influence countries, so it can allow or deny loans, but more specifically, it actually can set conditions on projects and loans. So it can tell countries, unless you do X, we will not give you the money, right? And it can continue to do that over the course of the loan. And that has made it, people have made the argument that that's made it uniquely powerful because it can kind of circumscribe and otherwise dictate, right, what countries have to do in order to have access to these monies. And so I think Latin America in the 1980s and 1990s, which is the area that I look at, is it probably kind of the strongest case, right? Because these are times when these countries were really desperate because of economic crises that they were weathering. And so the World Bank is kind of especially powerful during that time. So if we see the World Bank being able to kind of strongly influence the direction of countries, then I think that would be the case. And we would probably see it most strongly during this time period. So I think the other part of your question, so one was kind of why the World Bank and then why health. So I think, the World Bank historically has been the single largest external funder of health in developing countries. So again, it yields kind of this large financial power, not just on an individual case basis in terms of conditions on loans, but just in terms of the large amount of work that it does in health. And that set it up alongside the World Health Organization as a real kind of normative, not just financial power in health, in terms of just technical expertise, even evaluation kind of stuff. So what's really interesting is that some of the programs that I look at, it's really hard to find information outside the World Bank on how well the programs it's implemented have worked, because it itself is a really large powerhouse in terms of research and evaluation in some of these countries where, at least historically, not a lot of other organizations were doing work in health.
Yeah, so that sort of leads me into my question from chapter two, which is sort of, there's a few things actually from this chapter. So first, I think you referenced it already, but the 1993 World Development Report, and you say that really kind of crystallized this like neoliberal turn in health. So sort of like what that is, but also a little bit later in the chapter, you talk about like a renewed focus on the poor and their health outcomes. And like maybe for the demographers in the audience, like why is that interesting, I guess? So those two things.
So the 1993 World Development Report and then the focus on kind of poverty, were those the two things? Okay, great. Yeah. Yeah. So the 1993 World Development Report is seen as this kind of really seminal, I would say kind of watershed moment in terms of the way that the development community, the international kind of development community, thinks about health. And then the World Bank circles back in 2004 on kind of the report is about improving services for poor people. And so this is the only time that health kind of comes back to making this big appearance. And so I guess part of the thing that was surprising to me is that, like I said, a lot of sociologists have focused on the World Health Organization, and rightly so. And then on the other hand, a lot of kind of political economy and finance and political science scholars have focused on the World Bank, but not really its work in health, right? More particularly other kinds of work, right? Including it together with the IMF's kind of work in structural adjustment in other countries. And so I think that health is kind of, in terms of the World Bank's role in health, is a little bit kind of understudied. So partly what I aim to do with this book is kind of fill that gap. So in 1993, the kind of World Development Report talks about kind of poverty and a way in which we can solve health problems. And it I think it's important, though, to note that with 1980, with the publication of its kind of health policy report, it takes a very I would say kind of more universalist, even though it's a primary healthcare kind of approach and is very kind of pro just providing healthcare to everyone, what we today know as kind of a movement towards universalism, right? And then in 1993, we see this kind of economistic, right, for lack of a better word, logic that's taken on in terms of how we think about poverty and how we think about health. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I try to kind of disentangle is rights discourses versus these kinds of economistic discourses, right? So, you know, the Millennium Development Goals and beyond are saying that we need to invest in mothers and children. And no one's really going to argue with that generally, right? We think that better health is a good thing, right? And in particular, we want to invest in poor people and in maternal health and in infant health. Like, all of these are seen as kind of important areas. But there's a really important point to be made about whether we want to invest in the health of these people because they're human beings and we think that they deserve rights and that health is somehow seen as a right, or it's seen as part and parcel of kind of a citizen state contract, right, in terms of what the state is expected to provide to citizens, versus this other kind of approach that the World Bank really embraces in the report, which is a real human capital kind of approach. So the idea is that we want to invest in health because we want these children that we're investing in and the mothers that are birthing these children to kind of constitute a future healthy and educated labor force, right? So this is a really kind of different logic in terms of why the state should involve itself in health and what kind of investing, quote unquote, kind of investing in health does for people, right? And so I guess I should back up a little bit and say that the World Bank's kind of approach, both the World Bank and the IMF, they're fundamentally concerned with economic stability and economic growth, right? And so It kind of makes sense then, right, that this focus on labor is where we can plug in health to kind of make the argument towards economic growth, right? So we can do that also by when we invest in health and education, other social service, right, reducing poverty, because again, these are people who will become kind of a labor pool, and we are concerned with kind of human capital, right? So investing in people. And there's also kind of a real thread of efficiency kind of across. So in the first chapter, I really talk about this idea and this distinction between equity and efficiency as kind of goals in health. And where we think about equity as kind of equal opportunity, although some people equate it with equality, and then efficiency is just getting the same outcome for less input, right? The same output for less input, or better output for input, right? In terms of where we spend our money. So there's this kind of tension, right, between equity and efficiency. And I think that what's interesting to me is there's not a lot of kind of sociologists that have written a lot about this, particularly in the context of health. But it seems to me, kind of based on conversations and talks I've given on this research, that sociologists don't necessarily see equity and efficiency as in competition with each other. Sociologists kind of think that we can come up with policies that certainly can enhance both. And my sense is that this is really different from the way that economists think about this. So economists really think about health in a way where if you try to divide the economic pie into more equal pieces, the whole pie gets kind of smaller, right? And so these two are seen as kind of fundamentally at tension. And I think that that is really the approach that the World Bank has taken kind of historically to this. And I also, in that chapter, talk about how the World Bank has had kind of relatively stable financial commitments to health kind of since the 1990s, although there are a lot of, so while its spending has remained kind of pretty consistent, we have a lot of new players like the Gates Foundation and others that are coming in, and that this calls into question, right, how important or relevant the World Bank will kind of be moving forward. But I think that's kind of another question perhaps for someone else to write a book on.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, so then in chapter 3, you sort of take it one step further from what you were talking about, and you sort of point out the importance of looking at the World Bank in developing countries, and you sort of point out two things. So the economic changes associated with development resulting in demographic changes, and then how globalization may affect health. So I was hoping you could talk about those two things.
Yeah, so I think, I guess I'll just kind of, back up kind of a little bit to the first chapter, which is kind of the theory chapter. So I guess, the question kind of guiding the book is that, kind of, how is it that the World Bank, which is really viewed as this neoliberal hegemon in health, and by neoliberalism, I really mean kind of a market fundamentalism, right? The idea that the market knows best, and we should really, and really coupled with an anti-statism, right? The idea that we should keep the state out of markets because it kind of messes up issues that are best left to market forces of supply and demand. So the question is, why is it that we don't witness a sharp neoliberal turn, right, towards the market in health in Latin America since the 1980s, given that the World Bank is so powerful and that countries are so desperate for kind of external funding. So we also think about neoliberalism as kind of being associated with the efficiency side of the efficiency equity trade-off. And then I kind of identify six policy instruments that we can think of. And so part of, what my work aims to do is impose a little bit of analytic clarity on the concept of neoliberalism, which I think is a word that we throw around a lot. And I think that we're not really sure, or some of us aren't really sure what we mean. And we may even mean different things when we're talking to each other, in particular about what it means for health. So I look at kind of six policy instruments: at decentralization and deconcentration, which means kind of decentralizing state power, and deconcentration is seen as the political variety of that, and decentralization the geographic kind of variety of it. The second is a really popular tool, performance-based financing, right? The idea that we reward hospitals or providers based on kind of what they do. The third is kind of a separation of functions across and within institutions. So we can think of financing and purchasing and regulation and health at the systems level. We can also think about targeting, which is often seen as really neoliberal because we often think about targeting as the opposite of universalism. So targeting would be when we say we're going to provide health for just mothers or just, you know, people below a certain poverty line, et cetera, et cetera. The fifth is private sector involvement, which is probably the most kind of classically neoliberal. And the sixth is really a primary healthcare approach, which is seen as aligning really closely with equity, but interestingly ends up being also used as an argument for efficiency, right? So that people can get preventative care and care at the first level rather than being referred to kind of complex institutions like hospitals. So those are the kind of approaches that I trace. But when we look at kind of neoliberalism, you know, what we would expect is to see a reduction in public expenditures on health, right? If indeed we witness a neoliberal turn, right? And in particular, I look at a variety of different outcomes, right? So public expenditure weighted not just per capita, but also by GDP, which is really important in Latin America because countries are of vastly different kind of economic and population sizes. And most kind of interesting to me is the public-private mix of health expenditure. So what percent of health expenditure is public versus private? And to the best of my knowledge, my book is the first that, or my analysis, I guess, in the book is the first that's used conditions on loans. And so what I did is I used a data set produced by the World Bank to look at the number of conditions imposed on all loans, and then on particular on health and social service sector loans. And that really, I think, is important because it really gets at the primary mechanism that researchers argue should be the thing that's driving down public expenditures, right? So kind of if we have more conditions, oftentimes those conditions in the effort to kind of stabilize the economic system would be to reduce state commitments. And these are known as the suite of kind of structural adjustment programs, right? And so surprisingly, what I find is that conditions attached to loans don't have an effect on health expenditure, and they certainly don't have a negative kind of statistically distinguishable from zero kind of effect on health loans. And the other thing I find is that, of course, you know, these kind of legacies in spending across countries are really durable, right? Which is what historical institutionalists would tell us. And so I guess what's interesting, I actually just came back from giving a book talk at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I always forget what the acronym stands for, but and I got the kind of question of like, oh, well, this is surprising, right? You didn't find an effect and yet you kept going. And I think that this is really, you know, I alluded to it earlier, but this is really the reason that I wrote a book because, you know, the question that it raises, this kind of lack of statistical significance in the cross-section time series models that go from 1995 to 2009. And I'll just note that the reason that I start in 1995 with the quantitative data is that that's the data that the World Health Organization starts requiring developing countries to standardize the way that they report their health expenditures. So data before that tracks pretty well in terms of the trends in spending kind of at the region level. But it's a little bit kind of higher than the 1995 data overall, or starting in 1995. So, you know, I knew kind of going in, I had done some pre-dissertation research in 2009, and I had read pretty widely both kind of foreign scholars on this, but kind of methodologically, I guess I'll note that I think it's really important if you're doing not kind of this large cross-national stuff, but country-specific case studies that you are at least able to kind of read the language. Well, obviously you need to be able to converse in the language if you're doing interviews like I did, but It's important that you read in the language. Otherwise, I think you leave a lot of kind of local knowledge and local scholarship untouched, which is problematic for a variety of reasons. So I had kind of, you know, spent a lot of time reading, in particular in Peru. That was kind of where my pre-dissertation research was. And that research was a little bit too for kind of just kind of proof of concept to figure out if I could even get access to these high-ranking key informants and if they would talk to me about these things. You know, this kind of raises the question, you know, you don't find this effect. So does that mean that the World Bank and other international financial institutions don't matter for the way that health spending occurs or health investment occurs? You know, my argument is that the answer is more complicated than that, right? The World Bank's work varies across countries, and that's part of the answer. So this kind of, I guess, supply side answer in terms of the fact that the World Bank is trying to do different things across countries, but also that countries' kind of existing institutions kind of pattern the ways in which the World Bank both seeks to be involved and actually is able to be involved. So all of these kind of effects, I think, basically wash out in the regional kind of analysis. And I think that is where I come up with the kind of theoretical framework that I use of state capacity and autonomy in health as really shaping the World Bank's kind of involvement and effect on health sector reform.
That actually leads into the next thing, which is your case studies, which I, like you were saying, I think are really fascinating, right? Because there's effects happening, but it varies based on sort of what the countries are already doing or trying to do. So you first start with Argentina. So I was hoping you could sort of set the stage for that and what happens there.
Yeah. So, Argentina is kind of a really, all countries are very interesting, and certainly all the countries I chose are very interesting. But Argentina is particularly interesting because it might be the country with which the World Bank has had kind of the most extensive and maybe even the most successful kind of relationship in health in the region. And Argentina's kind of health sector is dominated by these kind of trade union health organizations called the Obras Sociales, or like the social works, I guess, literally translated. And they are kind of really dominant, and they date back to mutual aid societies. So they're along occupational lines. You'll find one for like commercial workers and one, I think there's one for like, you know, culinary employees. And so they vary kind of along these lines. And what's really interesting about Argentina is that in 1989, one of the informants in the book, Aldo Neri, is the health minister, and he's really kind of a visionary. And so he attempts to introduce a real universal public health system. And this system ends up failing due to these kind of trade-based insurance funds, the Obras Sociales, which are really opposed to this, right? They don't want to like take a cut in terms of their power. And so this is kind of really interesting. And so I define kind of, and I argue partly because of some really interesting research that's coming out of political science, that it's, and partly based on my own observations, right, that it's really important to distinguish state capacity and state autonomy in terms of what the state does across sectors, right? So it actually turns out, and I know there's some research on kind of different states in Mexico, that the ability of, and by that I mean kind of subnational, kind of federal states, right? So like, you know, Indiana and Wyoming or something, the equivalent kind of Mexican states, that there's no reason to believe that a state that has kind of, for example, large extractive capacity in terms of taxes will also have kind of a well-functioning, uncorrupt police force, right? That these are kind of different domains, and states may be really good at some things like health and really poor on some things like education, which really really contradicts really established kind of notions of state capacity and autonomy as we're kind of classically taught them, I think, for those of us that do state-based research. So I think that the way that I conceptualize state capacity and autonomy is that autonomy is really, and I borrow from kind of Peer Evans' embedded autonomy, it's the ability of the state to formulate collective goals, right? So does the state have a clear vision in my case in health, right? And then capacity, on the other hand, is the ability to actually carry out that vision, right? And so this draws from people like Michael Mann and Barbara Geddes, right? This kind of physical and institutional ability to implement reforms and, or according to Mann, I think he says to implement logistically political decisions throughout the realm, right? This idea of kind of the reach of the state and its ability to actually do the things it wants to do. And so I characterize Argentina overall as a kind of planner state because it has, for much of these period with Neri and then with Ginés kind of later on, another health minister, it has kind of a clear set of things that it wants to do in health, and it's actually unable to carry them out, right? And partly, largely, this is due to the Obras Sociales kind of opposition, right? They want to retain their power. And it's also partly due just to the federal kind of system of the Argentinian state. Each of the provinces has its own kind of health ministry or minister and has its own kind of obra social for the workers kind of within that state. So it's a pretty kind of disjointed and maybe I would say fragmented kind of health system. And so the work that I do in kind of the chapter is looking to see kind of what the World Bank did, right? So based on these allegations of kind of neoliberalism, we would expect the World Bank to oppose this this plan to kind of implement public and government-based universal healthcare. And it turns out that the World Bank is kind of agnostic about it. So it says, you know, if you put forward a loan and you want us to support this, then we will probably be able to help you. But we're just kind of going to stay out of it. You're going to need to figure out within your kind of system how to do that. And so I found that to be a really kind of interesting, to be kind of an interesting component. And the other thing that's interesting is that the World Bank ends up supporting a really kind of sweeping, maybe sweeping is a little dramatic, but a far-reaching, I guess, reform, which is the Plan Nacer, or birth plan, I guess it would be technically translated, that seeks to kind of provide care for mothers and children kind of across that either don't have obras sociales kind of support either for themselves or via family member, and really seeks to kind of do that. And so it creates a lot of kind of targeted programs. And so the World Bank supports another AIDS program that in the federal district of Buenos Aires, right, the capital. And so it ends up doing these things that we might view as kind of promoting state involvement in health, right? Which is again kind of counter to what we would probably expect of the World Bank. But I think what's interesting to note about this is that it's still pretty economistic in its logic, right? And the way that it justifies it is by saying that it'll feed into kind of human capital, right? And it uses these kind of policy instruments that I described earlier, right? Like this kind of rationalization of the health system, this idea of a separation of functions in terms of what it, the work that it does in Argentina. So
then you move into your case study about Peru, and here you sort of talk about the chapter is called Slow, Steady Health Reform in a Weak State. And so I was hoping you could talk about Peru.
Yeah. So Peru is, to me, one of the more interesting countries. And I guess I should note, I talk about this more in the conclusion, but I think these cases were chosen purely for kind of theoretical reasons. So I wanted a country each in kind of the quadrants of kind of low capacity, low autonomy, which is Peru, high autonomy, low capacity, right, which is Argentina, and then high capacity, high autonomy, which is my final case of Costa Rica. So I think that where Argentina is really informative to countries that are undergoing kind of recessions or problems that have a really employment-based health system, Peru is probably pretty informative to broadly kind of developing countries, in particular low and low middle income countries. because we can think about it as a really kind of prototypical weak state in health. So it's characterized by fairly weak autonomy. There's not a ton of clear health goals over this time period, and the really kind of weak capacity. So unlike in Argentina, the capacity isn't because the government is being blocked necessarily by other agents, which in the case of Argentina is the Obras Sociales, but Peru has kind of very little infrastructural ability to kind of carry out health reforms. And it has kind of limited financial resources, right, as kind of a developing country. And so Peru is really the place where we would expect the sharpest kind of neoliberal turn, right? It's the most vulnerable to international pressures, although Argentina arguably weathered the most severe kind of recessions maybe during this time period. But Peru is certainly the kind of poorest country in the 1980s of the three. And so it's really vulnerable to international pressures and social program cutbacks. And so I think what's really surprising about this case is it really displays the exact opposite trend, right? There's really an expansion of public health financing and coverage, though it's important to note that the provision is often subcontracted to private providers. And so during the presidency of Alberto Fujimori, who was a really kind of populist president, we see two kinds of insurance that are set up. So one, the Seguro Escolar Gratuito, which is like the free kind of school children, I guess, insurance, we would call it. And then the Seguro Materno Infantil, which is the infant kind of maternal health insurance, are put into place. And this is largely with monies from the World Bank. And it's important to note that the kind of landscapes of financing are different. So USAID is really very active in Peru, both at kind of a project level, but also at an institutional kind of systems level, in a way that it is not, according to my data, in Argentina or Costa Rica. So these two kind of come about. And what's really interesting about that, too, just as kind of a side note, is that there's a lot of the kind of welfare state canon, which is the literature that I kind of, I guess, grew up with, right, as a sociologist, leads us to believe that it's really kind of left party seats and democratization that would really cause social investments, right? That's kind of what we think about when we think about Europe and other OECD nations. But in fact, it turns out, and there's some additional indication coming out of kind of quantitative data on the developing world more broadly, that it's often actually perhaps right-wing, but definitely populist presidents in developing countries that are the ones that are expanding health systems in an effort to kind of maintain their power, right, and kind of, I wouldn't say kind of like buy support, I guess, of the people, right, or maintain support. So I think that this is just an interesting kind of side note about Peru, but this gets consolidated into the Seguro Integral de Salud, or the Integral Health Insurance, which really aims to create an overarching publicly regulated health insurance in Peru. Though some of the functions, again, are kind of left to the private sector, the idea is that the state is pulling people into this kind of health insurance, right? And so, you know, some of the things that are maybe expected do come to bear. Peru probably demonstrates most clearly in both the documents and the interviews the kind of logic of economic productivity and human capital as a way that's used to kind of advance kind of health, and in particular public or state involvement in health, right? And so it really kind of, there's, you know, I talk about in the first chapter this kind of increasing recognition that neoliberalism doesn't, it transforms rather than reduces the state's involvement, in that, you know, neoliberalism requires a certain kind of stateness or a certain level of stateness, and that states are the ones that are responsible for at least regulating, but also just kind of facilitating the types of market interactions that we think about when we think about neoliberalism, right? And so I think that, you know, Peru is probably the case that most strongly calls for us to understand that neoliberalism and neoliberal kind of reforms don't always reduce the role of the state, but sometimes just transform it, as kind of a more of a regulator. And I think that What is the other thing that's kind of interesting about the Peruvian case is that, you know, even in a weak state, there's a lot of movement towards universal care and health, but in a really kind of segmented approach. And I think, you know, one of my favorite things is that about this chapter to kind of talk about is that Peru really embodies oddly in this time period, right, the kind of paradoxical strength of weak states, right? So when you have a pretty I would say, I don't know if unstable is the right word, but when you have kind of a weak or segmented or disorganized central apparatus of the state and health, which is the case in Peru for much of this time period, it's kind of disjointed and it's almost too segmented to co-opt, right? So even if the World Bank had come in with a strong intention to co-opt it, which there's not actually a lot of evidence that that was the case, Peru is kind of able to withstand that, partly because there's a lot of kind of change, and this is not a strongly autonomous or capacious kind of state and health where a foreign, I guess, institution can come in and just co-opt it wholesale. So
then in your last case study, you've got Costa Rica, which in contrast to the other two, you kind of classify as a health without wealth situation. So, you know, they're scoring pretty high on health indicators like low infant mortality and high life expectancy. So I was wondering if you could talk about Costa Rica.
Yeah, so Costa Rica is really interesting. I think in terms of both the universalism of its coverage and its kind of fantastic health indicators in terms of life expectancy and maternal mortality and infant mortality, its profile is much more similar to a developed country than to a developing country. And so this is a really kind of interesting approach. Partly, this is due to the fact that in 1940, Costa Rica abolishes its military, its kind of standing army. And so that frees up, as you can imagine, a lot of money for social services, right? You can imagine what would happen in the U.S. if we didn't have a defense budget, right? If that budget could then be reallocated to social services. So this kind of is what ends up happening in Costa Rica. And it's probably second kind of only to Cuba, right, in the extent to which it is a universal system. So the Caja Costarricense de Seguro Social, or the Caja, the Costa Rican Social Security Agency, provides near kind of universal care with a tripartite kind of financing scheme. So employers pay, employees pay, and then the state finances or subsidizes those who are unable to pay. But what's really interesting is that also, you know, my data comes from interviews which provide a kind of private hidden transcript of what's going on, but also official documents that provide a public transcript. And I make an argument that those are important to look at because the public transcripts are the things that you can't change, right? Those are the things that the media and the public has access to. And they're also, right, when you, as those of us who do qualitative data analysis know, interviews come with their own set of issues, right? Because people will aggrandize their role or will sugarcoat their involvement or all kinds of things happen. And so a public transcript of documents is similarly limited, right, because it is also a public face and somehow. But and so I looked at kind of the World Bank documents, which I had access, like I said, to the population of, but I also looked at government documents. So laws, decrees, and then official statements by and reports by kind of the health ministry and other reports. And Costa Rica is really great because it is a treasure trove of data. Every 4 years, it publishes a national official development plan, and it has a section for each sector, including the health sector. So Costa Rica has really very consistent, which again, is consistent with its status as kind of having high autonomy, right, in health. It's really formulating collective goals in a really kind of meaningful way at a regular basis. And it talks about health and kind of as early, even before the 1980s and kind of the earlier development plans, it's starting to question the kind of funding model of the Caja or the CCSS. And so this is kind of a really strong indication that these pushes towards efficiency and this effort to contain costs is not necessarily something that's imposed by the World Bank or even by kind of global trade and kind of race to the bottom arguments, right? So the classic kind of argument is that we expect to see states cut back in social protections and particularly for labor and a reduction in kind of the collection of taxes and then the provision of social services based on the revenue from these taxes because they're competing for foreign investment, right? So the idea is that if a company is deciding whether to locate their factory in Costa Rica or the Philippines, right, the government will say, well, we'll tax you less or we won't require you to provide insurance or all kinds of things to kind of lure foreign companies in. And so this is why we expect globalization to kind of intensify neoliberalism and this kind of race to the bottom of stripping away social services and kind of protections and taxations and other kinds of things. So what's interesting is that the Costa Rican case really kind of signifies that the Costa Rican government was talking about kind of efficiency in health and concerns about costs and cutting costs well before the World Bank kind of ever arrives there. And so in Costa Rica, the real challenge in health is maintaining rather than establishing universal coverage, right? And it's drawn on the World Bank funds for some of its most important reforms. So, for example, in the mid-1990s, it creates primary health care teams, the EBAIS, or the Equipos Básicos de Atención Integral de Salud. And what these are kind of healthcare teams that exist per number of people in the population. And sometimes they're actual clinics, but sometimes they're actually mobile kind of units. And they kind of go around and are attempting to kind of both deepen kind of coverage, right, and access by being kind of more proximal, but also attempting to kind of de-escalate. So the idea is that, you know, if you get treated for an illness or an infection or something at kind of a lower level, then you avoid going to a hospital, which we know it costs so much more to treat someone for the same thing at a hospital just because of overhead costs and technology and these other kinds of things. And so what's interesting is that the kind of idea of a strong state being able to withstand pressure bears out in the Costa Rican case a little bit. But what's interesting is that the World Bank, even there, it just doesn't really push for state retrenchment in terms of health, right? They have some kind of debate. So, for example, in the EBAIS, Costa Rica wanted them to be headed by a nurse or a technician. Did I say Costa Rica? I meant the World Bank wanted them to be headed by a nurse or technician. And the Costa Rican government was pretty adamant that it should be headed up by a doctor, that was kind of the culture of the country. And I think this highlights something else that I talk about in the book, but I didn't really mention in kind of the first chapter, that we know a lot about what the World Bank does and kind of trade policy and a little bit pensions are the domain that we know most about what it does in terms of social services. But pensions are really about money, whereas health is about a bunch of different things and presents a bunch of different problems because of information asymmetries and principal agent problems. And also this idea of kind of the way that it intersects with gender and race and ethnicity and nativity status and identity, right? So Costa Rica really sees a large part of its identity as being tied up with this egalitarian, caja kind of approach to health. And this is kind of really important to its self-concept. And because it has proven results in health in terms of indicators, I found kind of some indication in my data that makes the World Bank even more interested in cooperating with it because the World Bank wants some credit, basically wants to come in and say, oh, yes, we also took part of that. And so we're helping this kind of approach. And so it's important, though, because the World Bank and kind of other IFIs, international financial institutions, can probably play a really important advisory and funding role, even in strong states that have established kind of health systems, given the fact that healthcare costs are skyrocketing, right, because of the transition from infectious to chronic illnesses. And of course, infectious illnesses are cheaper and a little bit more straightforward to treat. Also because of extended life expectancies, right, and the issues that are associated with aging populations, which I know is something that you do some research in, right? All of these things, right, are causing countries to seek out ways in which to cut costs and kind of manage the ballooning costs of healthcare. And I think that this is really contrary to the way that we've thought about the World Bank's work in health and the way that we've thought about, kind of international systems imposing market-based reforms and kind of cutting, coverage, right? Rather, these are issues that are a function of extended life expectancies and aging and health technologies that are kind of spreading, right? And chronic diseases and all of these other things that, frankly, we are already seeing, right, OECD countries encounter, and we should expect that all developing countries will encounter at some stage. So,
yeah, that's what I found to be really fascinating, is you sort of have these big demographic shifts happening in every country, but then, you know, the case studies present this sort of interesting compare and contrast between different, internal states and then what the World Bank does to influence them. So I really thought that was sort of an interesting way to kind of conceptualize what you were talking about throughout the book. But then at the very end, you sort of sum up, what you kind of take away, and you have both empirical and theoretical sort of takeaways. So I was hoping that you could sort of tell us about what you really, for anybody listening, what you really sort of want them to take away from your book.
Yeah, I think that part of the issue with marshaling so much data and having kind of three country case studies and drawing from all of these literatures, right, on welfare states and developmental states and kind of historical institutionalist kind of approaches, is that there's kind of several, I guess, important takeaways that were very challenging for me to kind of synthesize, right? Because you want a really clear narrative in the book, but then you're also like, no, all these things are really important. So I try to kind of throw those nuggets in the chapter specific, right? Like the paradoxical strength of weak states, right? And the implications of employment-based insurance schemes, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, in the conclusion, I just kind of go back to welfare state theory and kind of argue that we need to refine it, both kind of logic of industrialism theories that emphasize demographic and economic shifts, and also power resources theories that emphasize democracy and kind of global governance, and kind of state-centered theories that talk about kind of veto points and the structure of governments. We need to kind of refine those for the developing country context and consider that things are a little different. And I think I mentioned a little bit, right, how in some of these Latin American countries, it's actually populist and maybe right-wing leaders that are expanding social services, which is not what we expect in a developed country kind of context. So I think the kind of take home of the book is that the World Bank matters. It matters a lot, but it really matters differently across different countries. And that's what really the work that the case studies show, right? And that this difference is two-pronged, right? First, it's that the World Bank isn't attempting to do the same thing across countries. And again, I should note that methodologically, I focused on Latin America because it's a really interesting laboratory for third wave democratization, and it's coming out of a recession. And I'm trying to keep, quote unquote, constant the kind of legacy of colonial rule, right? It's Spanish. And so this is why I didn't do my work in Brazil, right? One of a couple of reasons. But also because the World Bank has a regional directorate. So we would expect it to operate the most similarly in Latin American countries because it has a Latin American Caribbean kind of bureau that it has. So we would expect it to be more similar than work that it would do, for example, in Malaysia as compared with Chile, right? Even though they may be more similar in other kinds of ways. So in many ways, I kind of do the most conservative test, right, for where the World Bank should matter. And I think that, I return to this kind of theoretical issue, drawing also on kind of a lot of medical sociologists that have done this work, where health is really not just financial and kind of monetary management, perhaps like pensions, but it also stands really at the core of citizen-state contracts and welfare politics and national and individuals' identities. And so it's a really complex field of understanding. And so when we try to parse out what neoliberalism and health means, that deserves important attention, right? And so I think that neoliberalism and health has been assumed more than it has been studied. And so I try to say, what would we see if we saw neoliberalism kind of advancing in health, right? Both in terms of the paradigms of equity and efficiency and kind of in terms of spending, but also in terms of the kind of policy instruments that I talked about. And I think that the kind of take home is that, you know, we need to distinguish between ends and means and kind of tools and outcomes. So a tool like targeting, which is seen as neoliberal because it's not, it stands in contrast, at least theoretically, to universalism, actually can work at the service of universalism. So Costa Rica is an excellent example of using targeting of indigenous populations and other types of populations to kind of deepen what is already existing universal coverage, right? And I think that I really kind of argue that state capacity and autonomy really shape the World Bank's interest and the kind of substance or content of its involvement in really sometimes surprising ways, right? As is the example of Peru. So I think that methodologically, I'm a comparativist always. So I think comparative research is really important. And I think that mixed methods research is always really important because if I had not had the kind of qualitative understanding that I did at that time of Peru, right, when I wrote the 2011 paper and kind of read the literature carefully, then I might have just stopped at a non-significant coefficient and then the paper just, you know, would have died and that would have been it, right? But instead, I think what the book shows is the importance of kind of leveraging these different types of analyses and triangulating kind of data and you know, the kind of quantitative data can tell us about trends and it can tell us about the correlates of spending. But in terms of really getting down to the dynamics of interaction, it's the documents that tell us what is the finally agreed upon product in terms of what loan agreements are signed and how people in the countries and in the World Bank kind of understood the success or failure of the programs. But the interviews really provide this kind of background information about what was happening that often doesn't show up in the official documents. So I think that the book kind of really intervenes, I hope, right, in debates about global health and global governance and health and kind of neoliberalism and health and about kind of welfare state or welfare regime, as they're often called in developing countries, kind of development. And I think, you know, the other thing that I hope the book does, and this is why it was really important for me to do the archival data at the World Bank archives, as a follow-up to my dissertation research, that was, I should say, funded by a fund for the advancement of the discipline grant by the American Sociological Association. So that was kind of really helpful for that research, was that it really bridges. It's not a book that's just about what's happening in the country, and it's not a book just about what's happening at the World Bank headquarters, right? So it really attempts to bridge this gap in terms of what the World Bank is saying versus what it's doing and how that's received kind of at the national level. So
today we've been talking with Sherry Noy about her book, Banking on Health, The World Bank and Health Sector Reform in Latin America. So, Sherry, what are you working on now?
So I'm going in a couple of different directions. So I think that I mentioned that I have kind of two primary strains of research. One of my strains of research actually looks at science and religion and kind of public attitudes. And this is kind of collaborative work that I do. And so I'm expanding that cross-nationally, which is really exciting because the research had been kind of on the United States. But in this kind of area, there's still a couple of papers that I'm working on in terms of how policymakers think about models for healthcare reform across these three countries. And then I'm actually expanding to do some collaborative work. So the book takes at its analysis level, the interaction between governments and the World Bank, right, and how this plays out in terms of political and health systems and health sector reform at the kind of macro level. And now I'm kind of working on papers that examine how the World Bank, I'm in the early stages, I should say, how the World Bank and other international financial institutions are affecting actual health outcomes in Latin America. So focusing on this question of maternal and infant mortality in particular, since that's something that the World Bank kind of pushed out as an important kind of policy goal and arena. So
great. Well, thank you again so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks. I'm Sarah Patterson. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Sociology.